Welcome back to another episode of the Jacob Johnston Show. You know, sometimes it is hard to get on this show and produce an episode day after day, episode after episode. As much into politics as I am, it still gets hard sometimes. And the reason for that is because it seems like we're going over the same basic stories repeatedly. You know, as if the country is stuck in some national version of Groundhog's Day, where the left goes out there and tries to promote the same narratives that have been debunked dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of times by now. And they always try to come up with some new lie in order to try and promote that same basic narrative. And sometimes it feels like, I don't know how to describe it really, but sometimes it feels like there's really no point, that we're not getting anywhere. Sometimes it just feels like all we're doing here on the right, rather than going through and actually talking about the ideas, actually talking about solutions, we end up having to spend all of our time marred down and debunking the left's newest narrative to promote an already debunked lie. And I think the left actually does that intentionally. Lie, 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 so that we spend all of our time debunking them. And by the time we get one lie debunked, they've already have 10 other lies out there, in order to be able to prevent us from being able to go through and talk about the larger issues, talk about solutions, debate ideas for new things that we can actually do that would be effective. And of course, the media is out there completely and totally dishonest, gaslighting the entire nation. And so it gets really hard to get out there and debate ideas and think about, here's the problems we actually have in the country. Here are some real solutions that we can try to address it. But the media is out there pushing one debunked narrative after another in order to keep everybody distracted from what's really going on, and instead going out there and trying to once again debunk yet another lie from the Democrats. And the question is, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Because if we try to ignore the left, we know what happens. The left goes out there, keeps lying, lying, and without any challenges to the lies, they will gain somehow momentum behind the lie, no matter how much evidence there is that what they are saying is ridiculous, but they'll gain momentum. And then at some point, just like in the school system, they will be able to go in with some claim of unchallenged narrative and then be able to get the country to, I don't know, overthrow the constitutional Republican democracy and think authoritarian government is a good idea. I mean, we are already seeing what happens when we go through and we don't make an effort to debunk the left's lies. You know, what happens if we just try to focus on policy and good governance, that we ignore some key critical areas that the Democrats can then use to try and take over sectors of, or not sectors, but power centers, in order to try and make it seem like the minority view has more support than what it actually does. I mean, what do you think? You know, because we can't just leave the lies unchallenged, because then with the media echoing it and everything, that people will start perceiving it as if there's some truth behind it. So we can't leave it unchallenged, but we can't spend all of our time debunking the same crap repeatedly and ignore addressing actual solutions to actual problems. So I don't know, maybe you have a better solution for me. Now, in this episode, of course, I'm going to be going off and showing some more exposures of the left. There's like a million examples. Every single day, I go through what's going on in the news. I go through my feeds. I take a look at what's going on, what's being reported. And I'm able to find stories out there that once again exposes the media for what complete and total frauds that they are. How the left is going through and implementing ideological subversion on the country. But then every once in a while, I see something in the news that gives me at least a little bit of hope. And so while I'm going to go through and expose once again the media and as well as the Democrats' ideological subversion, once I get through that, I'm going to take a look at a couple of things that at least gives me a little bit of hope. That despite all the lies, despite the ideological subversion, despite the censorship, that people are still finding ways to see through the frauds that the Democrat Party is. With all of that said, this episode, I'm going to change things up a bit. Instead of it all being doom and gloom about everything the Democrats are doing, I'm going to kind of give you more of a good news, bad news. I'm going to start off with some good news, and then I'm going to go through bad news, good news again, because I don't want the episode to get too depressing, taking a look at everything the Democrats are doing to destroy the country. I want to show you, in between each of these, that there is still some hope to save the country, to be able to save our democracy from the onslaught that the Democrats are engaged in trying to declare an all-out war on America. So in starting off with the good news first, a judge has rejected CNN's motion to dismiss Alan Dershowitz's defamation lawsuit. So Alan Dershowitz, a Harvard law professor, was one of the people that had defended President Trump during the Democrats' last phony impeachment attempt. And he made some statements while on the Senate floor. And CNN, selectively editing videos, did so in a manner that was meant to portray Alan Dershowitz as saying something that he absolutely did not say. So, from the article, a federal judge rejects a motion by CNN this week to dismiss a defamation lawsuit filed by Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz. While Dershowitz spoke for more than 5 minutes to answer questions from Senator Ted Cruz on whether quid pro quo arrangements are used often in foreign policy, CNN focused on a single sentence from his answer before claiming that the law professor was arguing that a president could do anything, including illegal acts, if he believed his re-election was in the public interest. But Dershowitz stated in another portion of the answer that the only thing that would make a quid pro quo unlawful is if the quo was somehow illegal. In its motion to dismiss, lawyers for CNN stated that Dershowitz's disagreement with CNN about the meaning of the words he spoke on the Senate floor is just the type of political debate involving matters of profound national importance that is central to American values of self-governance. It is not grounds for a defamation lawsuit. The lawyers further said CNN reporting was protected because it was pertaining to a government proceeding, that CNN cannot be held liable for reporting verbatim what Dershowitz actually said to Congress, and that the remarks made by CNN employees are non-actionable because they were opinion-based on testimony from the impeachment proceedings. The complaint alleges that CNN and all of the commentaries knowingly lied when they said this, and that they were lying when they said it. All right, because CNN's abridged version of Dershowitz's remarks omitted a crucial qualifier, its commentator statements are not based upon a fair and accurate summary of Dershowitz's statement to the Senate, Singel said. Okay, so I can go on and read this. I got this article from the Bongino Report, but basically what CNN's arguments are in its motions to dismiss is that if the statements were made on the Senate floor, then they don't have to report verbatim what was said. They don't even need to accurately portray it. They can openly lie about what was said because it was on the Senate floor and it's opinion commentator, right? It's opinion commentary. They're giving their opinions about what was said. And it doesn't matter if their opinion and their clip is them saying that he said the exact opposite of what he said. So let's go ahead and break this down a little bit, what CNN's argument is. So Dershowitz was saying that for a quid pro quo to be legal, there had to be something illegal about the quid or the quo. You know, otherwise, quid pro quo, which just means something for something, in and of itself is not illegal and is used often by everybody. You know, whether that is we, the regular people, going to the store, something for something. We exchange money for a product or service. That's a quid pro quo. Is that illegal? No. In foreign policy, it has long been the tactics that we say, hey, to North Korea, you give up your nuclear ambition and we'll remove sanctions. That is a quid pro quo. Is that illegal? No. And so what Dershowitz was saying is that for a quid pro quo to be illegal, the something for something, the exchange, What you are giving or what you are receiving has to be illegal. Otherwise, a quid pro quo in and of itself is not illegal. And CNN went out there and they cut the audio, they cut their clip very deceptively to just basically say that if, you know, a president, it is not illegal for a president to engage in a quid pro quo, which in and of itself is true. But then their commentators would come out and say, see what he is saying here, because he's lost his mind. He's saying that a president can engage in any illegal activity so long as he believes that his reelection is in the public interest. But that is not what Dershowitz said in any way, shape, or form. And there is no way you can construe what he said to that in any honesty. So Dershowitz filed his defamation lawsuit, and CNN's defense is, we can lie as much as we want as long as the comments were made in public and it's our opinion commentators lying. That is their defense. I mean, this is ridiculous that they even think that that is a rational or reasonable defense. And this is why I am so glad to see that the judge has rejected the motion to dismiss, saying, yes, there is a definite case here worthy of moving forward. Now, of course, in CNN's motion to dismiss, he basically wanted to skip the trial by jury and have the judge just, you know, dismiss the case as judge and jury on the merits. So the judge said, yes, this defamation lawsuit has merits, and rejected the argument that you can lie as long as it was about a government proceeding and the lies are coming from the opinion commentator and the lawsuit is going forward. This gives me hope. You know, that the media, just being the media, are not now so much protected that they can lie, defame, slander, libel. You know, they've been protected from lawsuits of those sorts by just claiming First Amendment, protected speech. But you cannot knowingly lie about someone and have it claimed as protection under the First Amendment. And whether you lie about a private citizen, lie about a politician, or lie about what someone said on the Senate floor, that is not protected. And then the reason why I have picked this article is because it gives me hope. It gives me hope that more people will start filing lawsuits against the media for defamation, for slander, for libel, especially Republicans. Right? Now, can you imagine in an election cycle, let's say, you know, we move forward ahead to 2022, and we're in the election cycle, and we're getting down to the general election, and the media polls their usual associate everybody as racist, and so the media goes out there and says, this person's racist, oh, this is a dog whistle to racism, oh, this is sexist, oh, this is homophobic, and they're saying so without the person that they're talking about actually engaged in any of that, and then having the every Republican candidate filing defamation lawsuits, slander, libel, however you want to put it, you know, filing lawsuits against every left-wing media outlet making those claims, and then suing them each for, say, $500 million, each one of them, 500, half a billion for each politician that they slander. This gives me hope that that could happen, because it opens the door to say, hey, even just giving your opinion commentary, you can't just go out there and slander somebody and accuse them of doing something that they did not do. And could you imagine, with as much as they slander, the every Republican candidate filing that lawsuit separately, what that would do to the media? And this lawsuit right here that Alan Dershowitz is waging, and the motion to dismiss being rejected by the judge, and if the judge goes forward, and it is found that, yes, CNN is guilty and Alan Dershowitz wins his case, the precedent that that sets for the future, for all the rest of the Republican Party to be able to sue the media every time they engage in the istophobic statements, you know, claiming everybody that disagrees with them is somehow, some way, some kind of istophobe. This opens the door for that. And maybe, just maybe, if enough people start suing the media, which is assumed, oh, you can't do that, First Amendment, oh, they have such deep pockets, you just can't win, that we are seeing more and more people filing lawsuits against the media for their defamation and slander and winning. And so if everybody starts doing that, if everybody starts stepping up, maybe after the media loses so many lawsuits to the point that maybe they are brought to the brink of bankruptcy, maybe they'll stop doing that. And as they are no longer able to do that, to basically just yell everybody who disagrees with them as some type of istaphobe, it will level the playing field, because then instead of engaging in slanderous action, they would actually have to base their broadcast on actual debate of the facts surrounding the policies and what the positions of the candidates are. And the more Republicans can turn the public conversation towards policy and debate and be able to remove from the Democrats their ability to just go out there and call everybody and anybody some type of horrible name, the more Republicans are going to win, because the Democrats can't debate. They don't have any facts or issues to back up their positions. They have nothing. All they do is they just make baseless statements, statements that defy reality, statements that defy facts, statements about how policies that have failed repeatedly are somehow going to be great, and then just name call everybody. So if we can disarm that name calling, you know, because them repeating it so often, you know, you tell a lie long enough, often enough, and big enough, people will begin to accept it as truth. If you can disarm the ability of the media to lie and slander, the Democrats are screwed. It will take them a long time to be able to readjust, to actually have to re-engage their brains and start thinking of actual ideas and policy agendas that have some basis in fact, that have some support, that there is something there that is workable, which they can't do at this particular moment, because they've been reliant so much on name calling that they've lost the ability to think. They've lost the ability to debate. And so, yes, this lawsuit gives me hope. And I hope there is a lot more lawsuits by everybody else who is baselessly slandered by the media. Sue them until they start acting like journalists again. Now, Alan Dershowitz's defamation lawsuit against CNN is not the only thing that is giving us hope. And going through my newsfeed, I am starting to see more and more stories of parents waking up to what is happening in the public education system, to what the Democrats are doing and pushing back. And maybe this is one of the hidden benefits of the coronavirus and the lockdowns, with the schools being shut down and parents having to find ways to keep their kids in education while the schools were shut down and doing so from home, that they were able to finally see what the schools have been hiding. See, what has gone on here with ideological subversion is that the schools have been engaged in trying to basically demoralize the nation. Right? Remember, there's two parts of ideological subversion. Demoralize the nation, starting with the student, and then expose and promote the ideology, not of your country, but that of your adversary. And they're able to get away with that because parents have become uninvolved in their kids' education. And that's not entirely intentional. It's hard to stay involved in your kids' education and being able to help them with their homework and guide them through it when you don't get any information on what it is they're being taught. So it's not only demoralizing and exposing to an ideology that is in direct conflict with that of the United States, but it's the fact that they've been hiding what they are doing, because all of this is going on in the classroom. Any homework they bring home are not about all of the left-wing ideologies and all of that. So parents are left kind of blissfully unaware as to what the schools are teaching the kids. But with the coronavirus having shut down in-person classrooms and such, and the parents being home because of the lockdowns and the shutdowns and all of that, that the students attending their classes online, the parents were able to start listening in to what it is the public schools were teaching the kids. And they were shocked and dismayed over what was being preached in the classroom. And it has kind of jolted them awake. And now they're going to the school boards during every school board meeting, and they are ripping into the school boards. And there is even efforts starting to gain momentum to start engaging in recall elections against members of the school board for what it is that they are forcing through the public school systems. I mean, it is unbelievable. And so we have more examples here of parents finally realizing what's going on in the public schools and pushing back on this. So in an article from Just the News, parents last fall were shocked to learn that during sex education, their young first grade children were taught about touching their private parts. That's right. The New York Post said the video of a cartoon utilized in a course included a boy saying, "Sometimes I touch my penis because it feels good," and a girl saying, "Sometimes when I'm in my bath or when mom puts me to bed, I like to touch my vulva too." The outlets have reported that parents complained about the matter and were notified they misinterpreted what was being taught. Justine Angfanti, however you pronounce that name, who last month sparked controversy for teaching porn literacy to older students at another school. "Kids have no less than 5 classes on gender identity. This is pure indoctrination," the mother stated. The educational institution has said that the complaints are just from a small group of parents about the courses last fall and had misinterpreted the materials. As they have gone through and tried to defend themselves, the school has made statements that this is part of a comprehensive health curriculum for students. Age-appropriate videos approved for students 4 years and older align with nationally recognized methodologies and standards. So this is a disgusting story for multiple reasons, you know, and it is part of the demoralization. First, they go off and they talk about transgenderism as if that is really a thing. No, you cannot change your gender. Your gender is determined at the moment of conception by your biology, by the chromosomes that you get. If you were born any other way, you wouldn't actually be you. So they're trying to confuse them on gender and then sexual orientation, trying to encourage more people to be bisexual, sexually fluent, you know, sleep around with everybody, the entire demoralization. But now they're trying to sexualize kids at an even younger age. I mean, think about this. First graders were basically shown videos that promoted masturbation, you know, teaching first graders who haven't even begun the process of puberty and teaching them that jerking off and masturbation for both men and women is something that is encouraged because it feels good. And then the parents speaking out against that, the manipulative language is, "These are nationally recognized methodologies and standards." According to who? You know, this is something that the left also likes to do, where besides all the disgusting things that they are trying to promote to the kids, is to try and take the most radical, disgusting, immoral positions and then claim that that's the majority view. To claim that these are recognized standards across the education system with a lot of backing. Well, the question is, according to who? Because I can guarantee you that this is not what's going on nationally, at least not in red states. What they are saying is that the Democrats want this, so therefore, if the Democrats make a claim, it is the national standard. It is the methodologies. It's all normal. They try to normalize the most radical behavior, and trying to sexualize kids is now being promoted as normal. But I can guarantee there's a lot of schools in Republican areas with a Republican school board that is not engaged in the attempt to sexualize children. I mean, what is the school's attempt here? Are they just saying, hey, you know, Planned Parenthood profits are sinking because kids aren't having enough sex and getting pregnant enough? So if we can just sexualize the kids earlier and demoralize anything related to sex, more young girls would end up pregnant as teenagers. And then they will seek abortions. And I mean, I'm just guessing here, you know, what it is, you know, why the attempts to try and basically sexualize kids and promote masturbation to kids as young as first grade. You know, but the whole manipulative language about, oh, this is normal. These are national standards for teaching. And you got to ask, according to whom? And see, that is a question that hasn't been asked, that more parents are now stepping up and asking. It's like, well, who's setting these national standards? When were they set? How long has this been going on? Parents are waking up to what is happening in the school systems. And guess what? It's not just the public school systems. It's also starting to go into the private school systems in Democrat areas, making it harder and harder for parents to get away from the liberal nonsense. But parents are waking up as a result of the coronavirus, as a result of being able to get more information as far as what the schools are teaching. I can tell you this, when my kids were in the public school system, and I've mentioned this before, I've pulled my kids out of the public school system because of what was going on, what I found out, you know, was being taught, you know, and I'm glad I did, because the public school system here has now gone in to promoting Black Lives Matter and so on. And I switched to homeschooling. And I know that's not an option that everybody can engage in, but I switched to homeschooling my kids, and I can tell you, their education has really taken off. They're learning faster, they're learning more, and they're learning more relevant things. Instead of transgenderism and masturbation, they're learning about economics, about how the economy, the world economy operates. They're learning personal finances, how to manage and handle their money. They're going to be going through entrepreneurship along with a lot of other things. So they're getting a much more valuable education. But when my kids were in the public school system, I had no idea what they were being taught. The information about their coursework was not being brought home. There was no textbooks coming home with them so that I could review what was in the textbooks. There wasn't much in the way of any homework being sent home outside of math, right? So I wouldn't be able to see, based off of the homework, what was being taught. We were left in the dark. And we would try to go through being responsible parents and try to get more information. Hey, what is it that they are learning so that we could be more involved in their education and helping them? And the school resisted as much as possible providing us any information over what was being covered. They provide us the generic, you know, oh, we're trying to, you know, read. Okay, you know, you're trying to improve their reading skills. What type of materials are you having them read? Maybe we can help. We wouldn't get that information. See, what has gone on for so long is that parents have been taught to be mostly uninvolved in the kids' education by the school system's refusal to let the parents know what's actually being taught. And so parents have become disinvolved in their child's education. And of course, they got other things such as, you know, needing to get up and go to work. And when they get home, they may want to have a little more fun time. But the schools have basically gone through and cut the parents out. And the parents are waking up. They're understanding, hey, why are you teaching my kids about jerking off? What's up with this? Why? What is the meaning behind it? What are the national so-called standards? Who developed them? When were those standards implemented? Who implemented those standards? You know, don't just fall for this whole Democrat argument that, oh, because they're the ones that are promoting it, that it is somehow normal, standard, and nationwide. No. It is some left-wing nut job decided, hey, let's try and promote pornography to the kids, you know, and we'll put it in cartoons and we'll sexualize kids and we'll just say it's normal. Some liberal nut job did that. And then for the older kids, you know, the middle school age kids, maybe early high school kids, they're promoting porn literacy. What does that mean? They're showing porn in school. Now, think about what type of environment that creates. You know, how women must feel watching porn, because we know how bad most porn is. So think about how that makes women feel. You know, having to view sex in front of their male peers, having to watch it with their male peers. And, you know, as far as it goes for men, think about what that's doing, how that's teaching them. I mean, have you watched porn? It is not based in any form of reality. And so going through and providing that visualization of how demeaning the girls are treated in those videos and making them think that that is somehow normal. Why? Why would that be going on in school? Now, another thing that the parents have brought up is, hey, shouldn't this require consent before you teach my kid? Shouldn't issues like this require the parents' consent? Letting the parents know, here's what we plan on teaching do we have your consent to teach your kids? No, the schools don't do that. The schools have cut it out so much, have cut out the parents so much that they don't even attempt to even engage in consent from the parents over controversial issues. They just deem this is normal and go along with it. So I'm glad to see that parents are finally stepping up, finally taking notice of what's going on in the education system, and finally starting to push back on it and letting the school board know that you need to cut this crap out, or we're going to recall you in a recall election, and we're going to challenge you in every election going forward so we can replace all this crap that you are injecting into the school system and change the schools back to an institution of education instead of the indoctrination camps that the left has turned them into. And it's not just the K through 12 school system. It's also the college education system, and people are waking up to that as well. And multiple lawsuits have been filed against multiple universities for their diversity and inclusion program. You ever notice how diversity and inclusion have become co-words for blatant racism? Yes, the left has turned words such as diversity and inclusion into just dog whistles for blatant racism. And so here is the background story, because there's two things going on with these different universities. And the first one, Rutgers University's Law School apparently has tried to implement a new rule as far as how student groups get their funding. So if you've been to college, you know that in addition to tuition to attend the college, you got to pay what is called student activity fees. And it's not an option. You are forced to pay that as far as going to school. And then that money goes towards the student government that then decides how to divide that money into funding various student groups. I know when I was on the student government, there would be an overall budget that is passed, and then students or student groups would come in and try to seek additional funding for some special event, something that they want to do that wasn't part of their initial budget, or to come back and try and get funding that was cut from their initial budget. And then the student government votes on whether or not to pass a funding bill to pay for that or to fund that student group's, you know, wants or claim needs. And that money comes from the student activity fees. Well, at Rutgers University of Law School, they tried to pass a requirement here that student groups would have to engage in promoting critical race theory. And that if they didn't promote critical race theory, then they would be ineligible for funding from student activity fees. Now, it's interesting because the members of these student groups also paid into the student activity fees. And so what was going on is the lawsuit challenges this rule, this requirement, as unconstitutional because it is a public university and they're violating the First Amendment by trying to force compelled speech, trying to force students to promote a political agenda, you know, critical race theory. Even those who disagree with critical race theory on the grounds that critical race theory in and of itself is just naked racism. But if they don't promote critical race theory, then they are cut off from the funding that all the other student groups will be able to access so long as they have at least one event promoting critical race theory as something good and basically trying to demonize everybody based off of their skin color if that skin color is white. And it is a form of compelled speech. If you're saying that your group is going to be discriminated against for not promoting a left-wing ideology, a left-wing political agenda, because you disagree with it. Maybe it's a conservative group, or maybe it's a non-political group that doesn't want to go through and isolate or exclude people based off of political ideology, or doesn't want to get involved in politics altogether, and forcing them into a political agenda. Yes, of course that is compelled speech, and it's compelled speech on the basis of discriminating those who refuse to engage in the compelled speech. And then, of course, there is the University of Oklahoma, which requires their faculty and staff to go through diversity and inclusion training. And then they must pass the diversity and inclusion training in order to be able to keep their jobs. Of course, if they fail the diversity and inclusion training, then they no longer meet the requirements needed to keep their jobs, and they could be fired. Of course, faculty may have a little bit of room here to push back if they are tenured. But if they're not tenured, then they either have to go through with this training or they could lose their job. Now, what's the problem with that diversity and inclusion training? Once again, it is compelled speech at a public institution. And so it goes on to read, the University of Oklahoma, on the other hand, refused to stop requiring faculty and staff, including some graduate students, to complete a diversity training that requires them to say things that they don't believe. They show that participants are not allowed to move forward in the training until they give a single approved answer to scenarios involving disability, gender identity, cultural differences, and the workplace. The training does not impose a specific way of thinking, but instead presents situational examples of how to engage with the broader world in a way that is understanding to all people and perspectives. Yeah, right. All right. And so here's what's going on. They're saying, okay, we got diversity and inclusion, and part of that is doing a webinar. And so they'll give you a scenario or a question regarding gender identity, transgenderism, right? And they have selected that there is only one correct answer on how to handle a situation. And if you don't give that correct answer, it won't let you move forward in the diversity training. But if you don't complete the diversity training, you could lose your job. So what they're doing here is they're forcing you, compelling you, on the basis of the left's political agenda, to regurgitate the left's claim. Even if you don't agree with it, even if you believe it's anti-science, even if you believe that what the Democrats and what the left's views are completely racist and anti-American, you are forced to answer the way they want you to answer, or you're not allowed to move forward. And it's not like this is, you know, a definite, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. You know, the answers are basically and completely subjective political opinion. But the training won't allow you to move forward until you regurgitate the left's political views. But if you don't complete the training, you could lose your job. This is unbelievable what they are trying to go through. This is how ideological subversion works. You know, it's not just the demoralization. It's not just the indoctrination, but it's also the forcing of compelled speech to force people to regurgitate a political opinion, you know, that the left's political opinion. And they do that for isolation, of course, because if everybody is compelled, forcibly compelled to regurgitate what the left's claims are, then everyone feels like if they disagree, they're the only ones that actually disagree because no one else is speaking out. Everybody else is just regurgitating what the left is forcing them to regurgitate. And of course, they can go through here and take the results of the test and then go through and try and promote, see, this is what everybody thinks. This is a mainstream view. So they force people to take a diversity training, compelling them all to have to regurgitate the left's view. And then they take the compelled regurgitation of the left's view by so many people as claims that their views are the mainstream, the normal. You see how the manipulation goes here. Now, the lawsuit against both of these universities was filed by the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, acronym FIRE. Okay, that seems interesting. But you can see what is going on here. The left trying to go off and force their political views, force people to regurgitate through compelled speech, or they're going to be discriminated against in the form of student groups losing funding towards their student groups that other student groups who go along with the compelled speech will have access to, and through the diversity and inclusion training, trying to force compelled speech. I know at the time when I was working at Wells Fargo, for example, we had to do our own diversity and inclusion training. And they gave us scenarios about transgenderism. And I answered honestly, you know, and of course I disagree with transgenderism. And it would be telling me wrong answer, wrong answer, wrong answer, no. And so I was unable to complete the training. And then, of course, management would ask me, hey, why are you not completing the training? I'm like, well, there's an error here. I keep answering the question, and it just won't let me move forward. There's an error here. I would not go through and regurgitate something that I completely disbelieve in, that I completely disagree with. You know, a complete political opinion statement. I disagree with it. And I'm not going to be forced to regurgitate a political view that I disagree with. So it's not just the colleges and the university. The Democrats are going through and trying to get this diversity and inclusion training, you know, what they call diversity and inclusion, in the private workforce to force people through compelled speech tactics to regurgitate left-wing political views, left-wing ideology, and threaten people's jobs if they don't, you know, regurgitate what the left wants them to say. Because part of manipulation, part of ideological subversion, is you got to force the people to accept the subversion, the demoralization, the views that are the complete opposite of that of the nation's traditional views. Now, you can force that through all you want, through captive audience. You can go through and force them to listen unchallenged. But the main part of that is the compelled speech, the forced regurgitation, forcing people to have to give answers that they disagree with. Because the more they go through and being held as a captive audience to these lectures and being forced to regurgitate those views or have their jobs threatened, the more they can go through with ideological subversion, the more, you know, people just rolling over, getting people, forcing them to just rolling over and accept it. Don't rock the boat or you lose your income. The more and more people that will eventually go through and accept this horrible, disastrous ideology, the subversion tactic. Because, you know, it's one thing to just hear it, but having to repeat it yourself reinforces the indoctrination, reinforces the subversion that is going on. So yes, it does give me quite a bit of hope here that people are pushing back in the education system, filing lawsuits, and then going off and starting to engage in recall efforts now that they can see very plainly what is going on. But not every story has a good ending. So, from Red State, Loudoun County teacher suspended for refusing to bend the knee to gender pronouns in classroom. So what is going on here is the school board has decided to push through things like critical race theory and transgenderism. And Loudoun County's public school system, you know, has removed a teacher in the past week because he refused to refer to students by transgender pronouns. So they have gone through, as part of their diversity and inclusion program, the school board had gone through and passed that, hey, all teachers must refer to their students using the pronouns that the students themselves have decided. So if a student just decides that they are the opposite gender, if a girl decides she's a boy, or a boy decides that he's a girl, then the teacher must refer to them by their preferred gender pronouns, not by what they actually are. And this is part of the expansion and everything. So anyways, this teacher here, Brian Cross, who is a physical education teacher, went before the school board to voice his opposition to this policy. You know, and as he was going through, he was basically made his argument while he brought up his own faith, you know, Christianity, yes, which right there, the school was like, yeah, we got to get rid of him. Now, if he talked about his faith in Islam, oh, yes, go ahead. You know, it's only, they're engaged in religious and political discrimination. But his main point of his argument is that he will not lie to his students, calling them by anything other than what they actually are. You know, and that he's not going to reinforce lies, that he is not going to contribute to gender dysphoria. And so, after he had voiced his opposition to the school board, he received an unceremonious email from the school principal announcing his involuntary and indefinite leave of absence. So here we go. You know, remember how ideological subversion works. You must remove any opposition to what it is you're doing. And the left does this all the time. You know, how many times do they try to make the appeal to some authority? The academics and experts in this field all agree with me. Well, that's because they remove, fire, and get rid of anybody in that field who disagrees with you. You know, it's forced. They stack the deck. They control the hiring and the firing. You either agree with them or you're fired. And once they fire you, of course, you're no longer part of that expertise group. And those who remain are, of course, leftists. But you see how this is going on in the public schools. They have a political agenda. They want to subvert the culture. And how fast and how quickly they go through removing anybody who is resistant to the ideology of the left, to what it is that they are trying to implement, no matter how radical. And this is how the public school system has gotten so radicalized, has fallen so much, and has been able to abandon education for indoctrination. Because they go through, they have their political agenda, and you either go along with it or you're fired. They just remove anybody. And this has created a huge ideological imbalance in the schools. And the left likes it that way. That way they get all the way from preschool to high school graduation and all of the college years, where they get to push their views unchallenged. And it's not like they're pushing, you know, math here. You know, the claims that 1 + 1 = 2. You know, an undeniable fact. They're actually pushing an agenda that is damaging, that is a psychological illness. And they're trying to normalize that and push people into that. They're taking something that is refuted 100% by all science and trying to force that anti-science view on the entire school system. So, I mean, this is just amazing how they go through and they get away with this, how blatant and overt that it is, and how they use the hiring and firing, and how they use the language to force people in there. And of course, what's the excuse? You're creating a hostile environment. You're, you know, engaging in some form of discrimination, or, you know, whatever. I mean, they use that language. So they go through, they control the hiring and the firing. They push their views. Anybody resistant to that view is fired. They try to reinforce the indoctrination and subversion through compelled speech. You see how this goes. You see how in the past 2 weeks, I've been able to come up with daily examples of ideological subversion, especially in the school system. It's no mystery. I mean, all you have to do is just open your eyes, even just a little bit, and you see this going on. And of course, it is great that we are starting to see the pushback. And what we need is to push back more, push back harder. We need to go after the school boards. We need to start engaging with our state legislatures, forcing an ideological balance in the school, saying, hey, you can't have a school system where 100% of the faculty and staff are all Democrats. You must force through, you know, the state's constitution that all public education systems must have a balance of the political leanings of the faculty and staff. Schools should be forced to put a complete outline of all the topics and views for every subject for parents to be able to review. And at the beginning of every school year, maybe parents should have the right to vote on whether or not certain things are and are not included, especially if those things are controversial and political in nature. Shouldn't parents have the right to vote on whether or not their kids are going to be told or talked to about transgenderism in the school, about the sexual education courses, at what, whether or not their child, you know, can be forced into those classes, or if it needs parental consent? Shouldn't parents have more of a voice and a vote in what is taught to the students? I think so. And that's where we need to start going. That's where we need to start going in recapturing the school boards and the hiring and firing process, and how we need to work through our state legislatures to say, hey, before you can include something new, parents need to be able to have a voice or a vote so that they can't just implement transgenderism and such. And shouldn't there also maybe be a vote by the parents as far as the textbooks? You know that independent groups should be able to go through, review the textbooks and determine, you know, whether or not those textbooks are trying to promote a political agenda rather than an objective fact, or at least an attempt at an objective fact and information. We need to engage in action here to give parents more control over what is being taught in the public education system, to remove compelled speech. This is great, and every state constitution should force an ideological balance in the schools so that no side can just dominate the entire system and just blatantly expel anybody for any disagreement with their ideology. Okay, so now let's try to get back into some cheerful side of the news. All right, from NTD News, Black Lives Matter St. Paul founder says he resigned after learning the ugly truth. So remember, if we go back to that video regarding ideological subversion and communism, what they had stated here, and one of the things that they warned, is that those who become disillusioned become your worst, most bitter enemy. But it also becomes the most effective enemy that you have, because they've been on the inside. They know the ugly truth about what's going on. And someone having defected from your side has a lot of credibility and weight in the statements that they make when they speak out against you. And this is why they make every effort to shut anybody up who has become disillusioned. Now, if the Marxists and Leninists have already taken over the country, well, the people who become disillusioned, well, they don't have the opportunity because they're just lined up and shot right away. You know, it's the whole, these idiots thought they were going to be in charge. No, they're the first ones shot. They're the first ones executed, because they'll be the first ones to become disillusioned by the process that it isn't what it is they were led to believe it would be when they were out promoting it. So we see the disillusionment happening within the ranks of the Black Lives Matter movement. So from NTD News, a Black Lives Matter chapter founder in Minnesota has resigned, claiming that the organization isn't concerned about helping Black communities or helping improve the education quality in Minneapolis, according to a video published last week. It's like, really? The Black Lives Matter has absolutely no interest and does absolutely nothing to help the Black community? Who would have thought? I mean, anybody looking at them knows that that is blatantly obvious. Richard Turner, the founder of a Black Lives Matter chapter in neighboring St. Paul, said he started the branch in 2015. He became disillusioned roughly a year after becoming an insider within the left-wing organization, according to a video released by Take Charge, a group that rejects various provisions promoted by Black Lives Matter. So they're not only coming out and speaking against Black Lives Matter, they're going to groups that are opposed to Black Lives Matter to speak out against Black Lives Matter. And it goes on to say, after a year on the inside, I learned they had little concern for rebuilding Black families, and they cared even less about improving the quality of education for students in Minneapolis, Turner said in a video. And this is on the heels of a USA Today survey found that 30% of Americans would describe Floyd's death as a murder, down from 60% last summer. That is quite a drop. That there was 60% of the population that actually believed George Floyd was murdered, and now that is down to roughly half of what it was. Why? Because the ugly truth tends to rear its head and smack the left upside the head. It comes amid recent controversies surrounding Patrice Cullors, a co-founder of the organization, who resigned after a series of reports about her real estate portfolio and finances. Following reports, publications last month, Cullors asserted that she didn't misuse any donations to Black Lives Matter. So yes, I label this in the good news category, because you now have people inside Black Lives Matter that wholeheartedly believed in the organization being disillusioned and coming out and going, this organization isn't anything about what it claims to be about. It doesn't do a damn thing for the Black community. And those of us who have been on the outside of Black Lives Matter, looking at them, looking at their actions, have been going, really? You're just figuring that out now? I mean, I'm glad that they finally woke up. It gives me a little bit of hope that even those who are hardcore leftists and doctrines engaged in a left-wing movement becomes disillusioned and can actually see through all of the lies. Now, remember, Black Lives Matter is an openly Marxist organization. And they're not even a nonprofit organization. They're not a 501c3 organization. They are a corporation. They are incorporated. And so when you donate to Black Lives Matter, they basically have no obligation to use the donations in any way, shape, or form in which you donated to them for, because they're not a nonprofit organization. They are a for-profit organization. And so some of the things that have come out here by leaders of Black Lives Matter chapters is how the organization doesn't support anything. They don't engage in any activities that are designed to improve the Black communities, you know, designed to, you know, bring back and, you know, rebuild Black families, to engage in any improvement in the quality of education for the Black community, or expand opportunities for the Black community. What Black Lives Matter does, the only thing that it does, is it tries to search and scan for the news, and they search for situations that they can manipulate and lie about. And their favorite thing to scan the news for is police shootings. And so if they hear of any situation where there's a police shooting where the officer is white and the perp was Black, they go out there and they promote a false narrative. This person was just gunned down. This is an example of systematic racism. And then they try to organize agitation. You know, they call it protest, but they try to rally and stir up the community into anger to engage in what they call protest, which is generally just mass violence, you know, looting, arson, you know, and just general violence. And they try to go through there and get the media's attention or get more media attention. And then they go out, they promote a false narrative about what has happened before an investigation has been concluded, to try and pre-write the narrative, try to, you know, claim more and more that they are a victimized group. And then they try to fundraise off of that. And then the money that they get from all of that doesn't go back into helping or improving the quality of life for the Black community. They just use it to pay themselves, you know, their large executive salaries. They pocket the money, and then they use that to engage in activities to further enrich themselves, to buy big luxurious home, luxury cars, and to expand their private investment portfolios. Meanwhile, the people who believed in them, started their own chapters of the organization, are not actually affiliated, are not actually, you know, with the Black Lives Matter Corporation. You know, they're not a subsidy, they're not a business unit. They just basically franchise. You know, and I don't know whether or not they have to actually pay in order to get the franchise fee. You know, that basically Black Lives Matter is operating off of the franchise model, you know, for their chapter, you know, at least, you know, as far as I can tell. And then none of these chapters receive any money or any funding from the main organization. And so everything that they do out of pocket. And they see that the Black Lives Matter organizers are leaders, our founders, are getting rich off of all the narratives and claims of the Black community, getting rich off of exploiting the Black community and exploiting the situations that are going on in Black communities. And they're getting rich off of it, but they're not doing anything to improve it. See, this is the disillusionment. This is how it goes in all Marxist societies, where on the rise to power, they claim things like social justice, equality, you know, a utopian society. And then once they're in power, all they do is engage in actions that only serve to enrich those at the top, leaving everybody else out to dry. And so this is why they have to get rid of people that were part of the initial buildup or the initial, you know, rise to power of the Marxists, because they become quickly disillusioned when they realize that the claims and the reality are different. They don't seem to match in any way, shape, or form. And so we're seeing more and more people who have been insiders in the Black Lives Movement coming out and speaking out against it, becoming disillusioned because it's not what they thought it was. It's not what the organizers believe it to be. I mean, let's face it. Right now, I can go off and I could try and pick a group of people that I think is victimized. I can create an organization, you know, give it a name such as anti-hate or, you know, Their Lives Matter or, you know, whatever. I can go off and I can create that. And instead of a 501c3, I would list it as an LLC or an S corp and then go out there, take money, and people can donate to me all they want. And as long as I set up the donation so they can't list it for any specific action or issue or earmark it for anything in particular, then as a private, you know, LLC for-profit organization, I can use that money however I want. Now, I'll use some of it to engage in marketing efforts in order to keep, you know, the money flow coming to me. But the rest of it, I could just pocket. And there's nothing illegal about it because I'm not promising on doing anything with that money. And because I'm a for-profit, it's perfectly acceptable for me to try and pocket as much money as possible. This is why Black Lives Matter avoided filing as a 501c3, because then they would actually have to take the money, if they did file as a 501c3, and actually use it for what it is they claim they are for, and try to avoid having any profits in which to keep. Okay, so there's just a couple more things that I want to get to as I wrap up this show. I see that I'm going a little bit longer than I had planned. So let's go ahead and move forward here. And pointing out the media's complete and total hypocrisy, they are ignoring, after years of going after Trump with mainly false claims here of racism, dog whistles, and supporting authoritarianism, they are now ignoring how Biden can't seem to stop quoting some of the most murderous dictators in world history. Most notably is his quotation about women hold up half of the sky, which he has repeated numerous times and is a quote from Mao Say Tung, or however you pronounced it. So he's quoting a murderous tyrant who was responsible for the deaths of about 45 million people in China, killed between 1958 and 1962. Think about that for a moment. He's quoting one of the most murderous tyrants ever known in history that comes from communist China, and he's quoting that person constantly, repeatedly. And the media hasn't said a word about it. Meanwhile, they kept bashing Trump if he had so much as quoted anything from Pat Buchanan, as the left tried to claim that Pat Buchanan supported Adolf Hitler. Well, I got a newsflash. Adolf Hitler had nothing on Mao Tse-Tung. I mean, we talk about Hitler a lot because of, you know, World War II, but Hitler was not the most murderous dictator. He was incredibly evil. But there are people out there throughout history, even after World War II history, that have killed more people than what Adolf Hitler did. And Joe Biden is going off and quoting them. Now, what does that say about the left? What does that say about the Biden administration? That they admire the most murderous tyrant in all of history that we know of. 45 million people killed in just a few short years. And yet they can't stop quoting them and promoting that person, you know, views, statements, sentiments, whatever, the justification that he used in order to enact his murderous authoritarian rule. If this was a Republican making such a quotation, you know how the media would react. But the media is complete and total hypocrites. And then it's not just quoting murderous tyrants that is the problem with Biden. Biden is starting the process of creating yet another dumpster fire that we are going to have to go off and deal with. And so you know how under the Trump administration, they found a way to effectively deal with North Korea. And as a result, North Korea hasn't said squat in years now. They haven't gone off and threatened the world or done anything crazy. Well, Joe Biden has gone through and decided, you know what? Let's do something to piss North Korea off and have them re-threatening the world again. So the Biden administration is lifting restrictions on South Korea's missile development program. And of course, North Korea is viewing that as a hostile policy. And what has gone on here is he's referring to a summit, North Korea, earlier this month between Joe Biden and South Korea President Moon Jae-in, which the U.S. ended its 42-year-long restrictions on Seoul's nuclear weapons, permitting the Asian nation to develop ballistic missiles reaching beyond previous limited range. Okay, so think about this policy for a moment. While we're trying to go off and convince North Korea to give up and abandon its nuclear weapons program, we are then going off and now trying to say, but their neighbors, who they've had kind of a hostile relationship with, will now be able to themselves develop their nuclear capabilities and missile programs, with which, of course, North Korea would see as an increased ability on South Korea to attack North Korea. You know, we know about the paranoia of North Korea, and so we can see the dumpster fire, that this ruins and eliminates all leverage that the United States could ever possibly have to convince North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons ambitions. Now, we haven't seen or heard anything about nuclear weapons being tested in North Korea in years. When was the last time there was a missile launch as a sign of threatening or harassing North Korean neighbors? It's been a long time because of the effectiveness and how President Trump dealt with North Korea. And just like everything else, Biden has decided, you know what? We don't have enough dumpster fires. Let's create some more dumpster fires. Let's create a problem. Let's create a situation and let's, you know, make North Korea feel more threatened so that they feel like they have to build up their nuclear weapons arsenal, their missile capabilities to be able to, you know, now North Korea's claims will be on responding or self-defense. This is just a stupid, dumb butt policy. First off, we should be working hard with all of our allies and all the world countries to avoid the development of more nuclear weapons. I mean, seriously, who's out there going, you know what, we don't have enough nuclear weapons in the world. Let's go off and give more countries the ability to develop nuclear weapons. Who goes off and thinks that's a great idea? Now, I get it. They'll try and say, you know, oh, it's for peaceful energy, just like they're trying to claim with Iran. But there is no evidence that it's for any type of peaceful energy. It's specifically for their missile capabilities. My God, could things with Biden in office get any worse? Can we see more predictably disasters and dumpster fires as they are emerging than what we have with Joe Biden? This guy, Joe Biden, I can say honestly that in the shortest period of time, he has become the biggest threat to the United States, the biggest threat to democracy, or at least he's leading the way to the party that has become the biggest threat that America has ever known. The biggest threat to democracy ever known to the United States is Joe Biden and the Democrat Party. They seem to be intent on engaging in any policy that would harm the United States, any policy that would destabilize the world. And this is being promoted as normal, a return to normal. Return to normal. You know, this is why people are sick of politicians and want term limits and limits on how many different elected offices that they can hold. Of course, the politicians say, but you need experience, experience. Well, that experience is crap if it's all bad experience. You know, we always get all this appeal to experts, and all the so-called experts keep screwing everything up. Keep getting everything wrong. You know, it just makes me really more and more thinking about making a run for public office. I don't know if I have a shot because the odds are pretty much stacked against anybody challenging an incumbent, you know, and pretty much stacked that the party leadership pretty much gets to hand pick who will and will not run in the primaries. No, or not who and who will not run, but rather who will and will not win by being able to direct funding towards their preferred candidate in any particular race. But it just more and more makes me want to go out there and challenge the incumbent. And the incumbent I would be challenging as a Republican if I did this. And I know exactly the clear-cut platform that I would be running on. Okay, so just a quick little rundown here. So according to Just the News, there's a report that an alarm went off and doors were left open at the building holding Georgia's ballot. So here it is. A judge has already given the okay for a forensic audit on absentee ballots. Now, after making that ruling, the left has finally decided that, hey, you know what? We're going to issue a challenge. And so they filed a motion and an appeal. And while the judge is considering that motion and appeal, suddenly the location, as it's being reported, where all these ballots were being held were broken into. The alarms went off, the doors were left open, and apparently there's no security. No one's guarding this. No one's protecting these ballots. So just before the forensic audit was just about to start, the left files a motion to appeal the decision. And while the judge is considering that, the facility where the ballots that would be part of the forensic audit is broken into. Isn't that just convenient? Isn't that just perfect timing? I mean, I could go off on an analysis for this on this forever, but I think we all know exactly what is going on here. Okay, in other news in Arizona, the Arizona governor, who claims to be a Republican, vetoes 22 bills. And some of those bills included election integrity efforts and actions against critical race theory. A Republican governor decides, you know what, we don't need to increase election integrity even after we saw all the crap that went on in the 2020 election. And you know what, we're not going to take any action against critical race theory. And of course, what is the excuse? They're not going to, she's not, or the governor is not going to sign any bill until they pass a budget. Now, the budget is not due yet, right? They still have weeks and they still have plenty of time to pass a budget. The bills that they have passed and sent to the governor's desk are things that have been worked on since the beginning of this legislative session. It took them all this time from the very beginning of the legislative session to work through these bills, hammer out the language, get them through the committees, get them onto the floor, voted and passed, right? And then towards the end of the session, that's when they normally work on the budget or work on going through and passing the budget. But this governor is saying, well, you know what? Even though the budget isn't due yet and there's still plenty of time, I'm going to veto everything you send to me until you pass the budget. Even though you've been working on these things since the very beginning of the legislative session. And yeah, whatever the excuse is. I mean, basically, it's just making up an excuse to avoid actually passing anything that would be part of a Republican agenda. Now, I'm not buying it. I am not buying the excuse that it's all about the budget when the budget isn't due for what, another few weeks, another, you know, month. And the things that was passed were things that were started on at the beginning of the legislative session. This is a smokescreen. This is a smokescreen that this supposed Republican governor is using in order to avoid anything that would diminish the Democrats' ability to subvert the culture and engage in election fraud. How does this person claim to be a Republican? This is what I'm talking about when I talk about rhinos. How rhinos are actually Democrats pretending to be Republicans in order to get elected in a red state. And then once they're in office, they attack Republicans and support Democrat agendas. This governor, I don't know when they're up for re-election, but this action alone deserves a primary challenge. This action alone demands that a primary challenge be issued and the next time they're on the ballot. Never mind the disgraceful handling of the 2020 election and allowing so much fraud to take place. That is just icing on the cake here. Or maybe your views is that is the main reason to challenge them and that this is the icing on the cake. However you view it, it has become obvious that this is not an actual Republican in office and needs to be primary challenged. So people, if you're listening from the state of Arizona, it's not enough to just pay attention to the federal offices, but you need to pay attention to your state and local offices. Figure out who the real Republicans are and who the rhinos are, and make sure to challenge and replace all the damn rhinos and all the useless Republicans who may just go along with, you know, the Republican program, but doesn't actually do anything to stand up for Republicanism themselves. Now, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to end this podcast on a positive note. So the last story here, Convention of States, Ohio lawmakers calling for the state to join movement for Constitutional Assembly. Yes, so here we go. From another article from Just the News, two Ohio lawmakers plan to introduce a resolution this week calling for a convention of states to address the size of the federal government. The two Republicans said they plan to introduce the resolution, which would create a convention that could discuss the topic of limiting the powers and jurisdictions of the federal government, term limits for Congress and other government officials, and fiscal restraints on the federal government. Having 34 states, or two-thirds of the 50 states, calling for a convention is one of the two mechanisms to propose a constitutional amendment. The other is a direct action from Congress. 15 other states have proposed similar resolutions. So 15 other states have already passed resolutions calling for a convention of states. 9 other states are currently considering this. So that is 24 states that have either passed or is in the process of debating Article 5, a convention of states. With Ohio, this would make 25. That means we are 9 states away from being able to invoke a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution. Now, I know the left is attacking this as, you know, a rewriting of the Constitution where all our rights would be on the table. No. After they propose the amendments, those amendments then would go back and have to be ratified by the states. It's a very high bar here. You know, what is it, 75% of the states then at that point would have to vote to ratify, 3/4? 38 states would have to ratify these amendments. And imposing things such as amendments calling for term limits for representatives and senators, maybe term limits for the judicial branch, forcing fiscal restraints on the government so that they can't spend us into bankruptcy, and taking back the powers of the state by limiting the power of the federal government and what actions they can and cannot take. This is good. This is good. Now, if I were to run for public office, I would definitely point out a, you know, series of legislations along with a series of constitutional amendments to basically do the same thing, to limit the power of the federal government, fiscal restraints, to reassert our rights under the Constitution, that the Constitution has to be interpreted as written, right? And so, and also a series of legislation combating censorship and a whole bunch of other stuff, right, that I would be proposing. But yes, you know, the federal government is out of control, power hungry, and abusive with that power. They are spending us into bankruptcy, leading us on a path to hyperinflation. The federal government has proven that it cannot be trusted, and it has usurped the authorities of the states, the authority given to the states under the Constitution, and a lot of that is due to the government spending and being able to say, hey, either you do what we want, or you don't get the spending bill, or you don't get any access to this grant money. Ooh. So yes, you know, I definitely am in complete support of Article 5, calling for a convention of states to propose amendments to the Constitution for we the people to vote on. All right, so that's it for this particular episode. I'd like to thank you so much for listening in. If this is your first time listening, don't forget to hit subscribe so that you never miss another episode. Also, make sure that you leave me a rating and review and share this on all social media platforms that allow you to post a link to this show. Thank you so much, and I will be back again soon.